Hi, I'm Greg Kokel with Stand to Reason, and this is our third session in our training in Street Smarts. So let's take a moment to review what we covered last session. First, I made the case that the simplest, most effective way to navigate tricky conversations, and also the way that will really keep you safe, is to use questions. Second, I shared four specific ways that questions can protect you in conversations. First, questions get you going. Second, questions get you valuable intel, right? Third, questions protect you from having to defend your own view. And fourth, when you're using questions, it's easier to get out, so it's easier to get in as well. Then I sketched out a tactical game plan to navigate those conversations using questions, and the first thing I suggested is to gather information using some form of the question, "What do you mean by that?" Second, reverse the burden of proof with some form of the question, "Now, how did you come to that conclusion?" And third, use questions to expose a weakness or a flaw in the other's view. That, of course, is the focus of Street Smarts. Now, finally, I gave you a sample dialogue that showed exactly how using tactical questioning can make conversations safer for you and more effective with the other person, and also enlist the other person as an ally in the enterprise. So here's what we're going to do in our third session together. First, I want to talk a little bit about the nature of the invisible spiritual battle you'll encounter in the street. This is spiritual warfare, okay? Second, in light of that, I want to give you some insight that will help you recognize the spiritual schemes of the devil that are in play in our culture right now. Finally, I want to introduce relativism to you. I'll give you a short tutorial on that, okay? So before we begin dealing with the challenges using the third step of our game plan, it's critical we know exactly what we're up against on the street. Now, in military terms, this is called intel, and good intel gives us the lay of the land before we start to move forward. To navigate the street effectively, you need to know the spiritual topography of the culture. So what is it that we're up against? In this session, I want to give you two important pieces of intel to guide you. First, I want to help you understand the chief spiritual obstacle that you're going to encounter. Second, I want to help you understand the chief ideological obstacle you're going to face. And then I want to show you how those two are connected, because the ideological obstacle is a deadly spiritual scheme that originated in the invisible realm, okay? I want you to consider a familiar passage that talks about the unseen world and contains an insight that maybe you haven't thought about before. Here's the passage. It's in Ephesians 6. This is where Paul says, "Put on the full armor of God so that you'll be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil." For our struggle, it's not against flesh and blood. It's against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. Wow. Now, in this text, Paul's telling us that we're in a spiritual battle. We already know this. Here's what you may not have seen before. Paul says that the devil operates according to specific schemes. These are battle plans of sorts. I want to help you see precisely how that works. And to do that, I want you to think about four passages in the New Testament that tell us the specific ways Satan fights his battles. Here they are. Revelation 12, the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. 2 Corinthians 4, the god of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving. 2 Timothy 2, the Lord's bondservant, Paul says, should not be quarrelsome. We shouldn't be getting in fights with people, but rather we should be patient when we're wrong. If perhaps God may grant that they come to their senses, watch the wording there, escape the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will. Consequently, 1 John 5, the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. Wow. There you go. Four verses. According to the New Testament, the entire world is in the devil's grip. He holds people captive to do his bidding by trickery and deceit. He blinds the minds of those who are perishing, and he keeps them from coming to their senses to see the truth. So this is key. What is the principal weapon that the enemy uses in spiritual conflict? It's not power. It's deception. The chief way the devil wins is by spreading lies. That means our most potent weapon against him is just the opposite, spreading truth. Gird your loins with truth, right? That's the first piece of our spiritual armor. To do what? To destroy speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. That's 2 Corinthians 10. And so this is the way the devil works. That's his weapon. But what about the schemes? Is there a way to see the schemes, the plans as they were? And I think there is, all right? Think of it this way. People who see, I mean physically can see, they're not blind, they walk around an obvious ditch, but people who are blind will fall right into it. Why? Because they don't know it's there. And the world has been blinded by the devil's lies. That means they're going to fall into spiritual ditches that we can see clearly, but they can't see it. So here is the tell, the giveaway, all right? Look for a big spiritual lie that seems completely obvious to us, a massive ditch that can't be missed, but the world is blind and can't see it. So the non-Christians fall right in. All right? Let me give you two examples, two schemes, I think, that are in play. I'll start this with a question. How about that? What single religion in our culture has the suffix phobia attached to it to protect it from criticism? Is it Jew phobia? Is it Hindu phobia? Is it Buddha phobia? Is it Christian phobia? No. You know what it is. It's Islamophobia. Why is that significant? Because, let's face it, Islam is arguably the most dangerous religion in the world right now. Yet lots of people think it's a religion of peace. Where did that come from? By the way, there are lots of kind and generous and peaceful Muslims, don't get me wrong on this, especially those you'll likely meet in your community. Nevertheless, there's hardly a day that goes by where there's not an act of Islamic violence somewhere in the world. And yet, any public criticism of Islam, in this country at least, is labeled bigotry. How did that happen? Keep in mind, by the way, that much of Islam is violently opposed to Judaism and Christianity. Now, maybe I have an overactive imagination, but does anyone else here see a spiritual scheme slipping past the eyes of the spiritually blind? Now, there's a second one, by the way, and this is one I'll cover in depth in the second half of this session, but this has been around for a long time, and people continue to be taken in by it, even though it's obviously false. And here's the claim. There is no truth. There is no truth. Really? So the flaw is obvious, right? When people say there is no truth, I can always ask, is that true? You see the problem. You can also see how the idea that there is no truth cuts the legs right out from underneath Christianity. Spiritual significance, right? Big ditch. People don't see it. Has spiritual ramifications. It's a scheme. And notice the pattern in both cases. You have something of spiritual significance going on in the visible realm that is obviously false, yet the rank and file don't see it. Each is a scheme to blind and deceive regarding something biblically important. So, if you want to see the unseen, here's what you do. You look for something spiritually important going on in the visible realm that is so obvious everyone else should be able to see it, but they don't. That's the tip-off. That you're dealing with something the enemy has doubled down on. Think of gender, for example, right now. You know, a male is not a male, and a female isn't a female. Men can have babies. Really? Okay, so you see the problem. We're in a spiritual battle. The devil holds the world in his power, and he blinds the world from the truth by using deception and lies. That's the formula. Now, there's one lie that's right at the center of Satan's schemes. It informs virtually everything that you'll face on the street. It's not a new deception, though. In fact, it was the very first lie. It's the primal heresy. In the beginning, there were no lies, right? Everything was good. The realm of God was ruled by goodness and truth, God's truth, all right? Then a deceiver intruded. and God's truth was challenged, and a counterfeit truth took the center stage. I want you to think about that. Genesis 3. Has God said? That's what the devil offered as a challenge. Okay? Oh, he's lying. He's holding out on you. He's not good. Do what you want. Do what your heart tells you. Truth isn't out there. Truth is in here. Make your own rules. Follow your own heart. Be true to your own self. Sound familiar? Now, of course, that's a paraphrase of Genesis 3, but it's familiar because that's the message of the era, right? At the fall, an alternative truth prevailed, the truth within, my truth. Now, don't miss this. The revolt in the garden was a rejection of the external source of truth in exchange for an internal authority. Self-rule replaced God's rule. Now, this outside-inside distinction, God's truth versus individual truth, the way the world really is, the way God made it, and the way I want it to be, I believe it to be, I feel that it is, that is the root of relativism. That is the primal heresy, the first sin. And relativism is the heartbeat of our age. It is the pulse of the street. Every generation has fallen prey to relativism in some form or another, but this generation, it celebrates it. It idolizes it. Let me give you a brief tutorial then on how to understand relativism, because this may be new to some people, all right? The word relativism refers to a particular understanding of what it means when we say that a belief or a statement or a point of view is true. So when I tutor students on the meaning of truth, I start with a statement, then I ask two questions. So I first make a dramatic display of placing a pen on a podium, okay? And then I say, the pen is on the podium. Then I ask the students if the statement is true. And when the students nod, of course, then I ask the critical question. What makes the statement, the pen is on the podium, a true statement? Well, I hand suit up. I say, well, because I see it there. And then I say, well, if you didn't see it, wouldn't it still be true that the pen is on the podium? I mean, seeing might help you know that the statement is true, but it isn't what makes the statement true. Some other student might say, well, because I believe it. But if you stop believing, would the pen disappear? No, of course not. And would believing really hard make a pen materialize on top of the empty podium? Probably not. Okay? Then I tell them, the thing that makes the statement, the pen is on the podium, a true statement, is a pen and a podium, and the former resting on the latter. Doesn't matter if anyone sees it. Doesn't matter if anyone believes it. It doesn't matter what anyone thinks at all. The truth of the statement, the pen is on the podium, is completely independent of any person's thoughts. It is, in other words, mind independent. Notice, by the way, that the students' first two responses tie the notion of truth to what was happening on the inside. I see it or I believe it, okay? Not on anything that was happening on the outside. That's a natural impulse of students because that's the way they think now. Again, remember, this inside-outside distinction is the key to understanding any form of relativism, okay? Whether the truth is from the outside or the truth is just on the inside. It's the difference between subjective truth based on what's on the inside, inside the subject, the individual, and objective truth based on what's on the outside, on the object, so to speak, the pen and the podium, for example. So here's another way of seeing it. If the truth you have in mind can change simply by changing your mind, then that truth is only in your mind. It's not in the world. It's based on something on the inside, not on something on the outside. That's relativism. Now, if the truth you have in mind cannot be changed simply by changing your mind, like if you don't believe in gravity, you're not going to float away, right? Because that's on the outside. then the truth is not in your mind. It's based on something in the world, on the outside, not on the inside. That's objectivism. So we're contrasting two things here. Subjective relativism, truth on the inside. Objective objectivism, truth on the outside. Or truth grounded in something on the outside. And by the way, objectivism, truth on the outside, that's the common sense garden variety understanding of the meaning of truth. This is what we always mean when we're casually making reference to the concept. When my philosopher buddy Frank Beckwith was asked once, what's the definition of truth? He said, well, do you want the true definition or the false one? So you get the point, all right? Now, this inside-outside distinction that I'm talking about applies in exactly the same way to all forms of relativism, including moral relativism, all right? In objective morality, moral claims are like the statement, the pen is on the podium, okay? Something outside makes the statement true. It's objectively so. So when an objectivist says abortion is wrong, he's talking about abortion. He's not talking about his feelings. He's not talking about your preferences. So when somebody says, if you like abortion, then get one, they misunderstand. The issue isn't whether I like abortion. It's whether abortion itself is wrong behavior, okay? Notice the conflict between the inside and the outside and the way people talk about this. So objective moral truth is like all genuine truth, it's always mind independent. It doesn't depend on our feelings or our beliefs or anything. By contrast, a moral relativism, it's not based on something outside a person, it's based on what's inside. It's their personal beliefs, it's their personal tastes, it's their preferences, what they like or what they don't like. And that's what determines if something is right or wrong for somebody else. So in relativism, actually, nothing is right or wrong in itself, objectively. It's only right or wrong if someone believes it's right or wrong. That's why people say, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. That's relativism. That's truth on the inside, all right? So abortion or premarital sex or homosexuality or anything else, frankly, is only wrong if a person thinks it's wrong for them. Morality, relativistic morality, is up to the individual. Right and wrong are determined by what's on the inside, not by what's on the outside. Okay? Now, with that kind of in mind, I want you to think about the culture. The culture, the cultural swing, the convictions of the culture, through and through, is always towards the self. That's why I call it the primal heresy. It goes back to the garden. Actually, the intensity of this began over a century ago, but it's shifted into high gear. It goes back to the beginning, right, but just for the last 50 years, it's really started kicking into high gear, and especially now, it's taken over everything. Today, a single slogan sums it up. You know what it is. You heard it. You do you. Okay? Two personal pronouns and a verb, nothing else. That's it. And the mantra is completely reflexive, be about me, okay? And that's the ruling dogma. That's what you'll face in the street. Some have called it expressive individualism, but it's all the same. It's narcissism, self-love. On the street, all meaning is determined by what's on the inside, what I feel, what I want, what I believe. Consider for a moment now how gender is viewed. Gender is no longer something that refers to something on the outside, our bodies. Rather, gender is completely a matter of internal preference, of personal self-determination, all right? Whatever I want, at the moment. Whatever I think, at the moment. Whatever I. Living out what you believe about yourself is now called being authentic. The slogan on a Ninja Warrior t-shirt reads, be your own hero. Think about that. Heroes are others we look up to because of some superior virtue, all right? Being your own hero means the self is the high watermark. Thus, hero worship is reduced to self-worship. And that's what you're up against on the street. And here's why this insight matters. If you don't understand how thoroughly the primal heresy permeates the current culture, you will not understand the hostility this generation has towards Christianity. That's why. To them, the objective truth that applies to everyone, Christianity, is the modern heresy. So when our first parents exchanged the external rule of God and the objective truth of His world out there for the internal rule of their own desires in here, that's the inside-outside exchange that's at the heart of all forms of relativism, they plunged the world into darkness. And that first lie, that primal heresy, informs and influences virtually everything you'll face on the street. From views on religion, to the existence of God, to ideas about sex and marriage and gender, obviously, to views on abortion and scripture and God's authority, etc., 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 etc. So be prepared. Put on your full armor. That's Ephesians 6, right? Gird your loins with truth. It's the first step in the battle for the souls of men. And that task, knowing the truth and defending it, is what the remaining sessions of Street Smarts will be devoted to. So let's review what we covered this session. First, we talked a little bit about the nature of the invisible battlefield you'll encounter on the street. That's spiritual warfare. The devil holds the world in his power. He does this by blinding the minds of unbelievers with lies. And our response then is to counter lies with truth. All right. Second, I gave you some insight on how to recognize the schemes of the devil that are in play in our culture. I said to look for the big spiritual lie that seems completely upside down to us. Islam is a religion of peace, or there is no truth, both obviously false. Yet the world is blind and can't see it. So the non-Christians fall right into the ditch and buy the lie. Third, we had a short tutorial on relativism. I call it the primal heresy because it was the first sin that broke the world. In the garden, man traded God's truth for his own individual truth. And it's truth determined and defined by what's in a person's own mind, called subjectivism or relativism, not defined by what's in the world that God made, which is also called objectivism. Relativism, you do you. Expressive individualism, be your own hero. That is the mentality that now rules the street. So here's your assignment for next session. First, see if you can find examples of issues with spiritual or moral significance where people's beliefs are simply upside down, but they don't see it. When you find it, take note. It's likely a result of a deceitful scheme of spiritual forces in heavenly places, okay? So second, pay attention for the subtle ways that individual feelings and finding your own truth, right? The primal heresy, are championed as the guide to authenticity, happiness, self-fulfillment, that kind of thing in our culture. Then be prepared to share whatever you discovered with your friends in conversation when you get together next time. In our next session, we'll begin to explore the most important question of all questions: is there a God? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. See you next time.